Tradition 4, each partner should be autonomous, except in matters affecting the other partner, family or relationship, or society as a whole. Autonomy means I have the freedom to do whatever I want to, but with it comes the responsibility for whatever actions I take. Now, I can ask myself, will this make him angry? Well, I know what things certainly will make him angry. And, you know, but the thing about it is, that's not the end of the world for him to get angry. We all get angry at times. But is it going to leave a lasting negative effect on my relationship? There's very few things. But what I do is I check it over with my sponsor and I'll say, what do you think? Because I've learned the mind is a dangerous neighborhood. Don't go in alone. And when your thinking is broken, my sponsor says, try not to use it so much. And every time I hear one person I sponsor say, I've been thinking, it gets me cold chills, just cold chills. And, you know, I have to be careful with my thinking because during the last year, before we got to this program, JD was not drinking. He was taking Anabuse. I had taken him to the doctor, and the doctor, JD's insistence, he wanted to take Anabuse because a lot of his friends were taking it. And all I wanted was for him not to drink because, you see, that was the only problem. Well, I found out that was not the only problem because he wasn't drinking. And that was the year I went over the edge. I couldn't blame him, but I did for everything. We couldn't get along on anything. It was the year of the dry drunk. And oh my God, that was hideous, absolutely hideous. And it was during that year that I got so sick that the committee came. And I was thinking, you know, I'm so miserable. I am just so miserable. Boy, I am too. Well, what are we going to do about it? I don't know. What do you want to do? Do you want to get a divorce? No, I don't want to get a divorce. Why don't you get a divorce? Well, I've already divorced one. If you have to keep divorcing them, what's the common denominator? We're not going there. Okay. So what do we want to do? Well, if you were a widow, what was that? If you were a widow, that would be honorable. Wouldn't be like being a divorcee again. I like it, but he's not dying. We can take care of that. Oh, how about? Well, let's see. You know, take an ice pick, stab him in the neck, and watch him drip. Oh, I loved it. I loved it. I would dream about murdering him. It's like, you know, before when he would get drunk, I would beat him up. And so, therefore, I release some of that anger. But see, I don't have anything to release that anger to because he's not drinking now. And so that's when the murder default came in. And even to this day, people at the group, when they talk about something, they say, well, what do you think? And I said, I think you ought to kill it. And they say, is that your go-to on everything? I say, pretty much. I said, that's my first thought. That's my default setting. I said, my second thought is my God thought that says, no, you're not going to. And I said, I didn't have that back then. And so I began to think about it. And there was a woman who killed her husband, said he was an alcoholic, and they put her in prison. So now I have to come up with another plan, one that's foolproof. Came up with it one night in the committee meeting. If an alcoholic were to pass out in the bathtub and drown, who would know? Who would know? We all liked it. It was a group conscience. So now all you have to do is just wait for the opportunity because, you know, sooner or later he's going to drink. He always does. And so when he got drunk the next time, and which he did, of course, and he came in and we had ice and snow on the ground and he came sliding across the yard in second gear. He sounded like he was doing about 30 in second gear and hit a tree and he opened the truck door and poured out. And I'd seen that too many times. And so I looked out my front window and I said, I'll kill that SOB if it's the last thing I ever do. And when he came through the door, I hit him as hard as I could and he fell and he hit the coffee table. And when he hit that coffee table, it knocked him out. And I drug him across the living room floor. I drug him into the hall, into the bathroom, took his clothes off, ran the bathtub full of warm water, put him in, held him under until the bubbles quit coming. And a voice came that was not a committee member And the voice said, look what you're doing. You can't do this. I picked him up by the hair of the head, put him back down again. I said, the hell I can't. And the voice said, do you not realize you're taking the life of someone you once loved? That's murder. No. Scared me to death. If you'd have told me I was capable of that, I would have told you were out of your mind. I was out of my mind. And so I am so grateful. When I lived in Newfoundland for 5 years, I worked for the American Red Cross, and I'm a senior lifesaver. Thank you, God. I knew how to resuscitate. So I jerked him out of that bathtub. I resuscitated him, dried him off, put him in bed, got the hairdryer out and dried his hair because I didn't want him to catch cold. Want him dead, but I don't want him to have a cold. Well, now let me ask you, ladies, have you ever been around a man with a cold? Aren't they the biggest? Do they ever have an ordinary cold? Don't they have Hong Kong flu, pneumonia, something like that? They just never have a plain cold, and they're so pitiful and complaining. I had rather had him dead than with a cold. And so I left and I went back into my living room, where I rocked and rocked until time to go to work the next day. And I went to work as if nothing had happened, because you see, denial is a wonderful thing. Denial. And see, justification is too. If he hadn't got drunk, I wouldn't have had to do that. It wasn't my fault. Until I got here and found out. So in order to be autonomous in your actions, you have to know who you are. How can you be autonomous if you don't know who you are? I'm a child of God. I'm one of God's kids. I'm more than a wife. I'm more than a sister and a daughter. I am more than those things. I'm a child of God. And my autonomous actions, just like the one I took back then, can be very destructive when my character defects come take over. You know, and the more fearful I become, the worse the defects come to play. And if you ever notice that defects love to play together, you never have just one. You have one that'll call to another, and it'll call to another. It's amazing to me how that works. I would go on, one of my defects was the disease of more. I would go on shopping sprees trying to make myself feel better. He would spend money we didn't have, and I show him I can do that too. Well, now, what does that show you? That shows you that we're going to have a lot of debt by the time we get to the program, because he's been spending money we don't have, and so have I. Now, when he quit drinking, that extra money that he was using for alcohol went away. It took me 4 years to pay for my trips to the mall. So who caused us the financial instability? It was me. It wasn't him. And I learned that when I wanted something from the mall, I used to walk every morning in the mall. I would go in, I'd say, oh God, I've got to have that. And I would take it home. And then I would look at it after a day or two, and I don't know why I got that. It's because I thought I needed something to fix me, make me feel good, and that buying that was going to make me feel good. And my sponsor says, I've got a cure for that. I said, what is that? She said, take it back. Oh, well, then you've got to admit you made a mistake. And she said, well, you want to keep it, or what are you going to do? I said, well, usually I give it away. And she says, well, that's stupid, because you're still going to have to pay for it. So she says, why don't you take it back and get your money back? And I did that so frequently at Dillard's that the girl, when I would go to buy something, she'd say, are you sure you really want this? Are you sure you really want this? Because I didn't realize that every time I bought something, they got a commission. And then when I took it back, they took it away from them. And so she didn't want that money going and coming like that. And so then I had the spike couch. I wanted this couch in spite of all things. I wanted a particular couch and a particular fabric, and I ordered it from the factory. And when it came in late. It came in 6 months late because they had had a strike, a longshoreman strike up in New York, and the material for it wasn't from Belgium, because it was a nice couch. And so I had to go without a couch for a while. But anyway, I got that couch in spite of everything. And I decided after I got in the program, I was sick and tired of that fabric, but I was going to keep it because it had to show me, it was a living proof of what I do when I think I've got to have something. I needed to have to keep something instead of just going ahead and getting rid of it, not looking at it. And my mind worked so fast. I didn't realize how my mind worked, but it's like one day, in the morning, up, and I was talking on the phone, and somebody's knocking on my door. And so when she came to the door, when I went to the door, the person there, it was just a salesperson. So I went back to the phone conversation, and or the girl I was talking to, excuse me, I'll get it right in a minute. The girl I was talking to on the phone had to go to the door, and she came back. And I said, well, thank God you got back. And she said, what do you mean? I said, I've just bought a microwave. She said, what do you mean? And I said, well, while you were gone, I was thinking, boy, I would love a bacon and tomato sandwich, but I don't have a microwave, so I'd have to cook the bacon on the stove, and then that would put the grease splashing all around. Then I'd have to clean up all that mess, but if I could put it in the microwave with the paper towels, I wouldn't have to do that. And she said, you'd get all that in about a minute. I said, yes. That's how fast my mind worked. And I was telling JD about it when he got home. I said, can you believe my mind works like that? He said, yeah, let's get one. I'd like one too. Mm-hmm. So we've had a lot of fun about that. One of the things you have to do in this autonomy is not fantasize about somebody else as your partner. Because when you start fantasizing that somebody else would be there, somebody else would be better, somebody else would be more handsome, somebody else would give you a better living, your affair has already started, even if it's just in your head. And we are not victims. We are volunteers. We make choices. We're responsible for the choices we make. Ego-driven individuals rarely have a healthy relationship. And that tells me why mine weren't. Because I always had to have my way. I used to say, I'm a natural-born leader. And the reason I'd say that is I don't know how to follow. I either lead or I don't go. I hated being at the mercy of what other people were doing. Whereas if you're leading, you get to make the choices. And I learned that there's a difference between affecting someone adversely or to their just getting angry at you. There's a big difference. And don't do things in order to get a relation or a reaction from others. Don't do that. I found out
no
that
cosas para tener una reacción nomás. No haga.
Okay.
April, you're still JD, there?
JD took an autonomous action. Yeah. JD took an autonomous action that just about pushed me over the brink. He had talked about making a water garden for the backyard. And he had been gathering books and magazines and stuff on water gardens. We'd been to botanical gardens. We'd been to all these different places. And one of the requirements is they're about 18 inches deep and they're about so big and what have you. I went off to speak at a conference one weekend. I came back on Sunday night. He didn't say anything about having made a water garden over the weekend. All I know is the next morning I woke up and I have two poodles and my poodles were in the bed with me and they were sticky and I'm going, what is that? And I turn on the lights and my dogs are covered in mud. And I'm going, oh my God, it's in my bed. It's on the carpet. Mud is everywhere. It's like the dogs have played in the mud and they've gotten all over the house. And I'm going, what happened? And I go and I look outside and I have a river of mud for a backyard. You see, it had rained. Now, when he was digging the water garden, instead of 18 inches, 5 foot would be better, wouldn't it? The alcoholic theory of more is better. So he had dig. Now, that's a lot of dirt. And so he had decided, I think he watched Steve McQueen too much, that he would spread it out all over the yard. And then it would just dissolve into the grass. Well, we had about 3 inches of rain. It didn't dissolve into the grass. It was a river of mud, the entire backyard. I couldn't believe it. And I called my sponsor and I said, talk me down. I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill him this time for sure. I really want to. I really want to. My house is destroyed. We have house guests coming in 2 days. What the hell are we going to do? And so she said, well, bathe the dogs. I said, Good point. Good point. First things first, bathe the dogs and don't let them out. Let them out in the front yard on a leash. Do not let them out. And so when he came home, I was walking the dogs in the front yard. And he looked at me and I said, go take a look at the house and come up with a solution by the time I get back. And he was just sitting here with his head in his hands going, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. And I said, that's right. Oh, no. I said, why didn't you mention that you were going to do something like that? Why didn't you mention you had done something like that? Why did I have to come home and just find it? Why did that happen? And he said, well, I figured that if I told you and you didn't want it, that you would tell me all these reasons I couldn't have it. And I really wanted it, so I decided to do it. And I said, well, there you are. Look what you've done. And he said, I am so sorry. I said, sorry, don't fix it. Sorry, don't fix it here. Where do we go? And so I was mad for about 3 months. And we just sort of lived in the same house. I wouldn't tell you anything to him because I couldn't say anything nice. I was so mad about the fact that he snuck around behind my back. And he did that, you know, on purpose. And, of course, he didn't do it on purpose to make the house muddy. And then it's like we had to cross fence the yard to keep it right up to the edge of the patio so that the dogs couldn't get out anymore in the mud. And it took a long time. And then finally we were having a yard party. And I said, well, we usually have the yard party in the backyard. Where are we going to have it this time? And he said, don't worry, Dorothy and I are taking care of it. Now, this is my sister that he didn't like, her best friend now. And so they used indoor-outdoor carpet for the entire backyard so that we had green grass in the backyard. It looked like a football field out there. I'm going, my God, that must have cost a fortune. And I told him, I said, how in the hell can we afford? He said, you don't worry about it. Dorothy and I are going to take care of it. And I said, okay. I lived over it, but it was a learning lesson for both of us. And he learned then, we don't do things that's going to affect the other, a person, our home or our yard, without running it past the other one. You know, don't, even if they don't like it or what have you, at least they have an idea it's going to happen, you know. And it took a long time to get over that because I didn't trust him sometimes when I'd leave home. He would tell me, he'd say, make a list of all the things you want me to do while you're gone. And when I'd come back, some things would be done, but nothing that was on the list. And so finally I figured it out. He was having me make a list of things for him to be sure not to do while I was gone. Because if I expected him to do those things, then I was disappointed. But, you know, that's what expectations are all about. And he says, I don't know. He said, when I would look at the list, it wasn't what I wanted to do. And I said, well, all right. So I quit making the list. I saved us both some trouble. Each marriage or relationship has but one primary purpose, to serve as an expression of God's love. And I must have an awareness of God's love within me before I can express it to anyone else. Before I can bring it to a relationship, I have to experience it, because I cannot transmit that I do not have. I heard a definition of love one time in a meeting. I don't know where they got it, but later I went and asked the girl for it. And she said, love is acceptance, understanding, and tenderness. It does not strangle, grab, or possess. It sees the other person not as a god or an idol, but as a human being possessing the strength and weaknesses of all human beings. Love doesn't ask to be served, only when it may serve. Quiet, gentle, trusting. It is composed of affection and desire without anxiety. And I thought, when I heard that, I never knew how to love like that. And so I came home. This was like within the first 2 years of being in the program. And I told JD, I said, I realized tonight that I've never loved you. And he said, well, I love you. And I said, well, but I read him that. And I said, according to that, I've never loved you. I've never loved anybody like that. I've never known anything like that. And And he said, well, does that mean you want a divorce? I said, no, I've already got you. I might as well try and work this out and use you as a guinea pig. We'll see how it goes. And like I say, it's gone pretty good over those last 51 years. But the thing about it is, what is God's love to me? Me as an individual in a relationship. The first thing is, it's unconditional. It's comforting. It's protective. Kind. Thank God it's forgiving. It's strong yet gentle. It's trustworthy. It's constant, unwavering. It enhances everything. God's love takes away nothing from your relationship. It only makes it better. God's love is happy, joyous, and free. And God's love is God's will for us. His will is to love us and for us to love him back. Did you know God always goes ahead of you and plans in love? Because you're his kid. What parent doesn't want to do the best for their children? You know? So God always goes ahead of us. Didn't God go ahead of us this year, people? When this virus came and we shut down our meetings, Zoom appeared. God had gone ahead and had Zoom in place so that we could see and have a face-to-face meeting right now. You don't have a face-to-face meeting with a mask over your face and 6 foot apart, but I can look at you. I can look at your faces right here. I can see your smile, or I can see your nod, or what have you, that I wouldn't be able to see your smile with a mask on your face. And I'm one of the super high risk on the ends. You see, I'm no longer mobile. I don't walk hardly at all. And my doctor tells me I've been in the house since the second week of March. And I know that drives a lot of people crazy, but you know, JD and I have learned that we love each other even more than we have before, because we're here together and we're going through a hard time together. And JD's 84 and I'm 78, you know, and here we are. And we have this relationship that we've never had before. It's so much stronger now from having to go through that. So God went ahead and planned in love, because see, JD's taking care of me. JD does all those things that I used to do. He does the laundry and he does the housekeeping and he's learning how to cook. Thank God. Only thing he knew how to cook when this started was hot dogs, and I don't like hot dogs, but I can tell you, he does make a mean tomato sandwich. God is all wise. God is all powerful. God is whatever I need God to be at any point. You know, when I pray and I ask God this morning, I said, God, be with me today and help me to share with the people the things that I have done that have helped my relationships. You know, help me to remember all these things. And of course, I have to have notes. My God, I'm 78. But I'm just telling you, I have notes. I don't have whole stories, but God is whatever I need him to be. And then this morning, I got to watch my son by choice, a gentleman I've been sponsoring for 26 years, do a wonderful workshop with some other gentlemen. And those are good things to my heart. You see, God went ahead and planned in love. And the woman who could not have children has so many. I feel like I'm the old woman lives in the shoe. I got more children I know what to do with sometimes. And these are my sponsorship family, my family of choice. I am the last of my family. I have no more biological family alive. But I have my program family. I can't tell you what that's meant to us. We have people calling us. We have people coming and putting surprise things on our front porch because they know I don't leave the house and we don't let anybody in, you know. And we have our groceries delivered. See, they didn't have a delivery service at Walmart to your house. They had one you pick up, but they didn't have one to your house. And I said, my God, I wanted this 20 years ago. I hated going to Walmart. Even in my motorized chair, I hated going. The first time I went to Walmart, my motorized chair, I wasn't used to using the little toggle on the side, and I made a quick turn and wiped out a hole in cap. Fortunately, it wasn't anything breakable. But, you know, I'm dangerous with that playing out in my stores. But when God's love is removed from a relationship, the relationship will die because self-will kills. You know, it tells you in the big book, self-will is like a tornado roaring through people's lives. And that's what I did with my self-will. But we only have one primary purpose. One primary purpose. And the focus is just one thing. That makes it real simple. We don't have to get so fragmented. Expressing God's love or God's will in your relationship. Not what I want necessarily. But what God wants. Well, how do you know God's will? Well, my sponsor has given me some wonderful tools. I have had the same sponsor for over 43 years. And she's 98. Excuse me, she's 97. Don't need to make her a year older than she is. She told me, ask God to let you see the people you love. Or others through his eyes. And this is what was going to help my relationship in expressing love to my mother. I had to see my mother through God's eyes. And so I would pray every day, God, let me see mother through your eyes. And I did it for over a year. And then I asked my sponsor, I said, how long do I have to pray this dumb prayer? She said, just till it works. I said, oh, okay. So I keep praying the prayer. And then one fall, I went by my mother's. And as I drove in the driveway, we had a long driveway, and she was out in the back field raking leaves. I noticed something about my mother that I had never noticed. My mother was short. I was 5'8". My mother was like, I wonder too. You know, she's a little bit short, dude. And I'm going, how would I not know my mother is short? I said, God, how would I not know? And the answer was, because you always come as a child, wanting from your mother, which you never got as a child. You always keep coming back, wanting, not coming to give something, but coming to get something. And as I walked closer to my mother, it's like I saw inside of her heart. And it was not a heart filled with love that she was withholding from me. It was a heart that didn't have it. You see, she left home at the age of 13. Her mother and daddy were both drunks. Her daddy tried to rape her, and so she left home. And she lived on the streets of Tennessee. She ended up in Memphis, walked hundreds of miles, stole food out of people's gardens, slept in the drainage pipes and stuff, was living in an alley when the lady who had a boarding house on that alley told her she'd give her room and board if she'd come in and help. My daddy was much older than my mother. He'd fought in the First World War, but he was there at the Second World War in charge of all the recruiting, but it wasn't that late yet. My daddy was born in the 1800s, and my mother was born in 1900. And so he took his meals at that boarding house. And when she turned 16, they got married in the parlor of that boarding house. And so my mother didn't have anybody to teach her about love. So where had I learned about love? In the rooms at open AA meetings and Al-Anon meetings. In the fellowships of AA and Al-Anon, I had learned how to live for fun and for free and how to love people regardless. My sponsor's a Black woman. When I came here, I was a racist. And she taught me to love all people regardless of their color, their creed, or anything. Just love them. Just love them. Because we're all hearts that hurt. That's what she told me. She said, you know, in here, we're just hearts that hurt. And a heart that hurts has no boundaries. And so I knew when I saw in her heart that she didn't have love, she'd been punishing me by withholding it. I knew if somebody was going to have to bring love, it was going to have to be me. So I walked over to my mother and I asked her to put the leaf broom down. And when she put it down, I said to her, Mama. And I put my arms around her and I gave her a big hug. And boy, she was stiff as a poker. Because we don't touch, we don't talk, we don't hug. Wasn't something we didn't do. And she looked at me and I said, I needed to do that for me. And every time I would go to see my mother from then on, I would give her that hug before I left. And then I noticed she began to stand up and come closer when I would get ready to leave because she wanted that hug, but she wouldn't hug back. But she wanted that hug. And so I began to do those things. I began to see my mother through God's eyes. And what would a loving mother, daughter, son, whatever do? You'd do things to make them happy. Things that would, and see, Mother's Day was so hard for me because to find a card that said, Happy Mother's Day, bitch, you just couldn't find one back then. But with a computer, you could make one. But I didn't have a computer. See, God wasn't going to let me hurt my mother like that. And so I began to buy her the kind of card she wanted to get. The kind of card that said you were a good mother. Even though I didn't like them, I didn't. My sponsor told me it doesn't matter. You do the right thing, regardless if you want to, how bad it feels or whatever. I said, I feel like a hypocrite. She said, do it until it works. And what it did was it made me feel better toward my mother. You know, and when my mother died, where were all those cards? Not the ones that I'd sent her, which I thought were so funny. But those cards that I sent her after I started doing that were wrapped with a ribbon around them in her chest of drawers. My mother had saved every one of those cards, and it was there from the last letter that my brother wrote before he was killed in Korea. So that was one of her treasures, one of her treasures. So another thing I learned was to give her the gift of time. Not to worry about her telling me what she ate or didn't eat. Give her the gift of time. Go to see her. Listen to her on the phone and accepting her like she was. Accepting her. And I'm so glad I did that because there came the day when my mother said to me, I want to ask you something. How come when your daddy died, you became such a rotten, ornery kid? I said, I was getting even with you for not loving me. She said, what do you mean I didn't love you? I gave you a roof over your head, close to where, food to eat. It was more than I ever had. And see, I knew it was. And see, all those years, I had taken that for granted. That's what parents are supposed to do. I didn't realize that to my mother, that would have been everything to have had something like that. But she didn't have the things that I wanted. But, you know, God went ahead and planned in love. I have a sister that was 16 years older than me. And that sister couldn't have children either. And I was like her child to her. And she did all those things I wanted my mama to do. And I didn't give Dorothy credit for it. And I blamed mother for not doing it. You know, how blind can you be? How blind can you be? So being an expression of God's love is not doing for someone what they need to do for themselves. But anyway, my mother looked at me when I said that. She said, I gave you that. She said, it was more than I ever had. And I said, Mama, it's enough. What can I do at this point in time to make it up to you for all the things that I have done, so many of them on purpose, to make you miserable? She looked at me and she said, forgive me for not being the kind of mother you needed. And I looked at my mother and I said, Mama, I forgive you. I forgive you. And my mother got up and she walked across the room and she gave me the hug and she kissed me on the cheek and she said, baby, I love you. I've always loved you. And I'd never heard her say it. I was almost 50 years old. God healed that relationship because I did what I had been taught in the program and by my sponsor to do. Give comfort and encouragement to your loved ones. It means giving them praise, positive strokes, praying for them, not centering in on their negatives, but encouraging them through their positives. You know, JD, he's one of the sweetest men in the world. Every day, no matter how ratty I look, boy, during the pandemic, my hair got down to here. Now, you see how I like to wear my hair. You know, my God, I felt like I had mane. I had a ponytail, for God's sake. And he would tell me every day that I was beautiful, even when I knew. But you see, because he looks at me with eyes of love, I look beautiful to him, just as he is one of the most handsome men. And he has a wonderful, huge head of white, beautiful hair. There's so many people like Rick, our son by choice, he's bald. So he's always saying he envies JD's hair, but it is beautiful. Looks beautiful. JD sends me love notes. I fix him coffee. I try not to be tacky when he wants to watch Westerns or something on TV like Forge with Fire. My husband's a welder. Why wouldn't he like Forge with Fire, you know? And what have you. But we like to watch TV together. And we hold hands and we watch Forge with Fire. And it's okay, you know? I like to give him comfort, not criticism, especially when he hurts himself. You know, JD, he's 84 and he thinks he's 48. And he got out on the stepladder here a couple of months ago, was doing something, and he stepped off the stepladder, and when he fell, he hit the rocks around the water garden. Thank God he didn't go in the water garden. I told him, don't you realize you could have been killed? You could have drowned, and any person in this world wouldn't have me put away. You know, I said, they know my history. You know, you would have me arrested if you got drowned in the water garden. But anyway, I mean, he was bruised up and had a black eye and all like that. And I told him, I said, you promised me you wouldn't get on the ladder. Well, I was only going to be there for a minute. And I said, well, that's okay. So I called one of the girls I sponsor and I said, bring your truck over. I want you to take all the ladders away. Because I said, I can't be worried because you see, I can't walk out to the back very easily. It'll take me 30 minutes to go from here to the outside. And I said, and I can't worry about if he's laying out there dead in the yard from falling off a ladder. And so God went ahead and planned in love and sent me a wonderful, wonderful handyman. I have Jesus. God sent Jesus, and he is a gift from God. He does everything. He does everything. And JD said, he asked him the other day, he said, when something happens to me, are you going to continue to take care of Mary Pearl? He said, Mr. Thompson, I certainly will. And so I told him, I said, see, there Jesus loves me too. But there's a new intimacy between me and JD. There's a greater love today than we ever had when we first got married so many years ago. And we didn't know that people are doing the very best they can and they need compassion and forgiveness, not judgment. And we had a tendency to do that. You know, I told my sponsor, she told me, she said, you know, on the last three inventories, you have had judgment and criticism right up there at the top. And I said, I don't really see it as bad. And she said, what do you mean you don't see it? I said, well, even the Bible says a tree is known by its fruit. I'm just being a fruit inspector. She did not find that amusing. And so, you know, she gave me a little thing to say, and I had to put it on my refrigerator, and it said, has God deserted heaven and left it up to you to decide and judge what people should or shouldn't do? No, he's still in business. He knows when to wield the rod. So remember when you're judging, remember, you're not God. So I had to give that up. But love and forgiveness are the qualities of the higher power. That's the reason it's so important that we have God in our lives. And it was hard to give myself the right to make mistakes and to forgive myself. And if you can't forgive yourself, you can't forgive others. Remember, God forgives you as you are willing to forgive others. It says so right in the Lord's Prayer. Give that person another chance. That's what forgiveness is about, giving somebody another chance to do better. I can't put myself above God, and God forgives me, so I must forgive others. And it's easier when you can forgive yourself. I expect less of those I love. I allow them to make mistakes. The kindest thing you can do when someone makes a mistake is keep your mouth shut instead of having to grind them down with it, you know? Giving that person, you know, allow them the dignity to fail and make mistakes is a real neat way to show your love to another person. You know, just keep your mouth shut and go on. Common courtesy in driving. Having fun with a hairdryer. I got to tell y'all, one of the first areas I saw improvement when I started in the program was in my driving. I was a very aggressive driver. I was always mad. And so I would yell at people. I'd blow the horn at them. I would do obscene gestures and what have you. And so when I start getting off a little spiritually out of whack, people in driving annoys me again. And so when we have the kind of heat that we had last year, oh, God, it was hot here, be 120, whatever, and the humidity 100%. It's just like you chew air. And people were not being very kind with one another. Everybody's patience, you know, when it gets too hot, everybody seems to get in a twit. Just like now with this virus, everybody's killing one another. Don't understand that. But anyway, I was driving down the road and their driving was bothering me. And so I said, God, help me to have a sense of humor and do something that will take my mind off of that, or at least not let it bother me. And that's when it occurred to me. I have a car. I have a 1992 Caprice Classic LTZ. Now, this was a car that was the favorite of the state police way back in the day, like in the 92. And I bought that car brand new, had it delivered, ordered it from the factory, and I've kept it ever since. I keep cars 20, 30 years, whatever. I love my cars. And this one's in my will. But anyway, I was driving down the road and I realized I have a state trooper hat. One of the girls I sponsor is a state trooper, and she gave me a state trooper hat. And I have this unmarked car. And so I went home and I had an old hair dryer and I cut the cord off of it and I made me a radar gun. And when people would irritate me, I would pull up behind them and I would hold this gun. And they would either pull off, speed up, slow down. And I would just die laughing, having more fun. And I even have my, the other day, I had a picture, not the other day, it was before the virus. I had my picture made in this year's state police car holding their most modern digital gun. And they took a picture of me because they were dying laughing over at the state police headquarters about me and my hair dryer. And I asked the girl I sponsor, I said, can I be arrested for impersonating an officer? She said, with a hairdryer? I said, oh, okay, I can have fun then. And so I did. And I still do. I said, anybody can come and tell you, my hat's in my car, and so is my hairdryer, just in case. And I had to learn gratitude. And I had to be a positive customer instead of being a negative customer going to the grocery store mad when he was drinking and I would manage to get my groceries without going past the beer counter or anything like that. I was so mad all the time. One time though, I made him go with me so I could watch him. You know how we have to do. We have to watch them so they don't escape. And we were looking in the meat counter. Now I'm looking at the pork chops and everything, and I decided I'd move down. And he didn't realize I had moved down, and a little lady about my age now stepped in between us. And all of a sudden, I heard smack, because he had a habit of slapping me on the ass. And I heard that smack, and I heard her say, I beg your pardon. And he goes, my wife, and she looked at me and I said, I've never seen that man before in my life. And he ran from the stuff. Oh, I don't have to do that to him anymore, but that was so funny. But anyway, I was not a good customer. And the people there in the store, they would get... It got to the point where the manager had checked me out. I was such a rude customer. And so I was telling my sponsor about it, and she says, well, you have to make a living amends and be nice to those people. So I made it a point to go down the aisle with my cart, skipping, asking them, how are you, and being nice and funny, but I didn't want to. And after a while, I started joking with them and having fun with the checkers. And one day, one of the girls says, Miss Thompson, I really love your unusual eye makeup. I said, unusual? What do you mean unusual? And I said, well, thank you. And I got out to the car and I look in the rearview mirror and I have one purple eye and one green eye. I don't know what I was thinking that morning. But anyway, it gave them a charge. It was just me. But, you know, after I had been such a rotten customer all those years, one Christmas, I got home and in my groceries was a Christmas card. And I thought, oh, my God, I shoplifted a card. I don't remember buying a card. And I looked and it was from the checkers and the sackers telling me that I was their favorite customer. That would never have happened had I not been able to change and to be a positive person and to treat them with dignity and fun. That just would never have happened. And then I had to learn gratitude for God's world. You know, that's by not littering. And even when I see litter, pick it up, you know. You can say, well, I didn't do it. But, you know, what the heck? Taking care of God's little creatures, you know. We feed the birds and we feed the squirrels. And JD had a turtle refuge. We had over 100 turtles, mock turtles at one time. And we had to get rid of them because a couple of puppies that we had began to chew on them and think they were toys, and we didn't want them hurt. And, you know, JD took and rehomed them. And then one day he had this albino that used to turtle that would meet him in the gazebo, and he'd feed him a strawberry. And all of a sudden, one day we looked in at the gate trying to get into the back was the albino turtle. He had come home. And, you know, be a better neighbor. You know, I had a neighbor. I didn't call her a neighbor. She was a woman who lived next door. And she was a product of an alcoholic husband who was also a gambler. And her children ran a show over there. The little kids ran the show. And I had had problems with her. And I would pray for her and pray for her. And then she wouldn't cut her grass and she wouldn't make her kids do it or anything. And it was hard. And then one year I said to JD, I said, I heard her window unit air conditioner quit working in the hot summer. And I said, take her one of our big box fans, because we have ceiling fans, plus we have central heat and air. I said, take that over to her so that she won't be suffering. And so she used it for 2 years, and then she brought it back and said it broke. Would I please fix it? I didn't levitate, almost, but I didn't levitate. And I told her, I said, I don't think so. But anyway, bless her heart, she's dead and gone now. But I've learned to listen. And did you know listening is an act of love? Listening is an act of love where the listener listens and gives himself completely to what the other person is saying without trying to think of what you're going to say and rebuttal or whether what they're saying is true or even relevant, but just giving them your undivided attention, you know. And I know my sister used to irritate me for a long time when somebody would ask me something, Dorothy would answer, you know, and that's like I looked at her and I said, do I look like Charlie McCarthy to you? I mean, what is the deal here? You know, you don't have to answer for me. And I realized that that was just part of Dorothy, and I had to love her even if she did finish my sentences. But then there came the point where on November, 45 years to the very day, I watched my daddy die, my sister died in the car with me. And I got her over to, I was going, God, what do I do? Do I drive? Do I do CPR? What do I do? I was in bumper-to-bumper traffic outside our biggest mall in the state. And all of a sudden, I saw a motorcycle cop coming. And I told him, I said, I think my sister's had a heart attack because she choked and her eyes rolled back and she quit breathing. And So we had a new hospital that just opened 2 weeks before. And so he made the traffic part for me to get through, and he led me to the hospital. And Dorothy was blue by the time we got there. And he went in and got the people with the gurney, and they came out and they took her in, and they put me into a separate room. I didn't go into the waiting room with the other people. And they told me there was probably nothing they could do. But what had happened in the meantime, I had taken her to the doctor that morning, and the doctor had run some tests, and they didn't have the results back. And so he had tried to call at our homes and tell us that Dorothy was in kidney failure. And but we weren't there. We were on our way back home, and it stopped by the drugstore to get her prescription. And we were coming right out from the drugstore when she died. And they were able to resuscitate her. She was in a coma for 30 days. They didn't know what we would have when she woke up, if she would wake up or what have you. And I was there in the ICU combing her, brushing her hair for her. You know how ratty you look in the hospital. I was brushing her hair. And all of a sudden I heard her say, "That feels so good." And I stopped and I looked and I said, "Dorothy, did you just say that?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "I can't believe it." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, for one thing, you've been in a coma for 30 days. And she said, "Oh, okay." And I should have known something was wrong. And we called the doctors in, and Dorothy has no short-term memory. And she had lost 40 years of the current memory. So she couldn't save anything anymore. And she couldn't remember, but she could remember me and JD. And she would ask me time after time, "Why didn't Mama come to see me?" I said, "Because Mama's dead. She died in 1991. And she'd say, like no emotion. And I took her to the cemetery and I showed her Mom and Daddy's grave. Well, of course, she remembers Daddy died. And she sat there and she said, "You know, when you can't remember, it doesn't seem real." That was the reason, no emotion. It wasn't, when you can't remember, it's not real to you. And so I took care of my sister. I had the privilege to care for my sister for the next 12 years. 1 year for each of those minutes that she was down. And she taught me a lot. Like I would say to her, "How can you stand it not having a memory?" And she said, "Well, you have to accept the things you can't change." I said, "Do tell." You know, I get so tickled at her, you know. But I learned to not to be argumentative. Don't burden someone to try to make you happy. Your happiness depends on you and your choices. And I learned to use God's love instead of sex to go into a relationship. That's the reason, you know, you'd start a relationship, you go into sex, and they go downhill from there. You know, sex is a part of love if you do it right. But sex does not bring love. Tradition 6, a partner ought not be overly supportive spiritually, emotionally, or physically to the marriage or relationship, lest problems of ego gratification divert him or her from the primary purpose, which is to serve as an expression of God's love. So this is where we learn caregiving rather than caretaking. And I learned that good with Dorothy. You know, she didn't need a caretaker. She needs someone to give her care. And, you know, if I'm going to take care of you now, if I'm going to be a caretaker, I can make a vegetable out of you. And that's what I darn near did with the alcoholic, because I did everything for him to the point that when he sobered up, he didn't know how. He didn't even know what size pants or shorts he wore. Because I had been buying all of his clothes, taking care of all of his, every need he had, I took care of. That was, I need to be needed. So there we are. But see, my need to be needed and my self-esteem were dependent upon each other. When I was a kid, I had a best girlfriend. I would do her homework for her. She couldn't see very well. But she finally got her some glasses and she didn't need me. I was devastated. See, all that time I was doing her homework and everything, I felt needed, I felt loved, I felt all that. But when she got the glasses and she could see the stuff herself, she didn't have to have me. So So I did at the job, I would do more and more in the workplace than anybody else and then feel overburdened and underappreciated, you know. And somebody would leave and they'd say, can you do her job too? Oh, yeah, I can do that job too. And so when I left, I was doing three
days.
Deborah, thank you. Like I say, I would get doing all these jobs. Were they going to pay me for three people? No, they did not. And then I would get resentful. And see, with JD, I had this mother-child relationship. I dressed him. I took care of him. I took care of the finances. I gave him directions instead of information. We had a real bad weather forecast, and we were going to have some ice and snow here. And that's not normal for here. And so he had this little lightweight truck. And so I heard he was sleeping because he's working nights. And so I gave him the weather report. I said, they say you're supposed to have ice and snow in the morning. Now there, I've given him information. Could I shut up? No. So you better put some extra weight in the back of the truck over the axle so you won't slip and slide all over the road. Like he didn't have enough sense to think of that. So when he came home, he mentioned the fact he had slid all over the road. I said, well, why? Did you not put the extra weight in the back? He said, no. I said, why not? He said, because you told me to. See, when somebody's trying to force something on you, you'll go against your own better judgment just to not let them tell you what to do. And I don't think that, you know, it's just like JD, he's a rose grower. He was. He's not able to get out there and do him that. Excuse me. And he had a whole row next to the house. And he said, I figured out why those don't grow as well. And I said, why? He says, it's because of the water coming off of the shingle. He says, it's the granulation that stuff on the shingles is bothering my roses. And I said, oh, that's just an excuse to get gutter. Don't try to pull the wool over my eyes. He said, no. And I said, well, I don't believe it. And he said, okay. And so we got the gutter. The roses did wonderfully. I wanted to go out and put salt on them just so I could be right and he would be wrong. You see, I didn't believe him, but he knew. But I was wrong one more time. So I had to get this addressing him. And that's why I told my sponsor, I said, that really bothers me. I'm tired of addressing him because I lay out what I want him to wear, and then he won't want to wear it, and we get into an argument, and then by the time I get him dressed, then I'm running late, and I don't have time to get dressed, and so I'm late wherever I'm going. And she said, don't dress him. And I said, well, what'll happen? She said, I don't know. We'll see. She said, you can dress him and shut up and not bitch about it, or you can not dress him and shut up and not bitch about it. I don't like my choices. So I decided I was going to let him dress. So he would come in from work, and he would take his clothes, start taking them off as he'd come in the front door. And I've always wondered what it is men do to their underwear that once they take them off, they can't touch them again, but they can't get them in the clothes hamper, even though it's right next door. I can't understand why they can't do that. And so here was his clothes all over the house, and I can't pick them up because she told me I couldn't dress him, and I couldn't pick up the clothes. And I said, okay. So anyway, on Friday night, after we have a week, clothes in the floor, the dogs are playing tug of war with the clothes and what have you. He brings some guys home with him after the meeting. And the first thing I hear him say is, oh, well, you can see Mary Pearl's not much of a housekeeper. I nearly went up the wall. And I said, yes, and y'all can see those are not my jockey shorts. You know, and then it was like all of a sudden he saw the clothes were his. They weren't mine. They were his. And, you know, I've not had to pick up clothes again. When I began to have a hands-off policy and a mind-your-own-business one, I got a taste of what it felt like when my sister was trying to mind my business. You know, that's what I got the taste I saw, you know. When I practice this tradition, I see things differently. I'm looking through a new pair of glasses. JD's smart, talented, artistic, has a great ideas, creative, funny. He's able to take care of himself. You know, I got tickled. There was a girl that used to come and watch our dogs. And she also worked with some of the Alateens at the time. And so she carried this gigantic soft purse. And J.D. picked it up out of the chair to move it over one night when we were someplace else. And he said, my God, what does she have in a purse that would weigh that much? So he had some chunks of asphalt. He put them in her purse to add to all the other weight. When she left, she slung it over her shoulder like it didn't weigh anything, and off she went. Well, the next day at work, somebody wanted a safety pin. She says, I've got one here somewhere. And she emptied her purse, and out came those chunks of asphalt. And she said, those Alateens, they've been in my purse. And she was telling me about it, and I went, oh, wrong kids, wrong kids. She said, what do you mean? I said, wrong kids, wrong kids. Don't blame the Alateens. And she said, you mean? I said, wrong kids. I can't say, but. And so she would stay at our house and take care of our dogs. So the next time we went out of town, we came back. J.D. said, after a couple of days, he said, when are you going to do the laundry? And I said, well, honey, you got lots of laundry clothes that wasn't in the laundry. He said, well, Linda had sewed all of the flies shut on his underwear. She was getting even for the asphalt. So it's fun around here sometimes. No one can meet the needs of another. Our separateness is our mutual strength. And that's what, you know, I'm better in some things than he is. And he's better in some that I am. But it's when we put us together that we can do that, make the whole deal work. Encourage your partner. Give them freedom to grow and learn at their own pace. Let them make their own mistakes and give them the dignity to fail. And our best relationship is one where dependence is mutual, independence is equal, and the obligation is reciprocal. This means we're a partnership. We both depend upon one another from time to time, yet we're independent and can stand alone and be okay. And our obligation is to live on a give and take basis. That means we have some balance. We do things as a team. What we can do together, we can't do separately. And we even have fun doing it. You know, one time we were out bagging leaves because we heard that the weather forecast was coming, and we had raked the leaves all up, but we hadn't bagged them. And they said it was going to rain. And I said, oh, my God, the wind will blow all those leaves. And we're out there at midnight bagging leaves together in a hurry to get them all up. And we did. We did. You know, when you are totally dependent upon another person, that isn't living, and it's sure not love. You know, don't be an emotional leech tied together by sickness. That's what we had a couples group, and we had a couple in our group that they were tied together by sickness. And as they began to get better, they wanted a divorce, and they were friends, and they still have holidays together because of the kids. If you can't be responsible for yourself in the relationship, you will never be an equal in that relationship. You'll always be dependent on someone else to do for you what you can't do for yourself. And are you too needy? I didn't realize how needy I was. But if you have to ask questions, now, you know, Al-Anons are so good at questions. We are gatherers of information. We want the questions. What's the matter? Are you okay? Who, what, when, where, how? We want all of that. And you've got to remove that. Remove that from your vocabulary, you know. Because we gather all this information, but what can you do with it? You can't do jack shit with it. Well, you got it, but boy, you got the information. You know, we become investigators. We become, you know, privatized. We follow. There's nowhere the alcoholic can hide. We can't find him. I truly believe that, you know, because no matter where he hid, I would find him. We played hide and seek, but I would find him. And that's the reason when we were looking for Osama bin Laden, I knew if you could give me 5 Al-Anons, I could find that sucker in a week. It would not be a problem. Trust me on that. You know, and the thing about it is, when I don't know something, that worries me. But not knowing is not a bad thing. Because it taught me in the ODAT, what you're supposed to know will come to you without any action on your part. Because, you know, a lot of times when we go looking for those things, we find out the answers to those things, and we wish we hadn't. You know, You see things that you can't unsee, and you say things that you can't unsay, you know. Not knowing is not a bad thing. And I'm going to end it for there. And if you have the courage to come back next Saturday, we'll finish them up, the last six. Thank you, Yvonne.
Thank you, Mary Pearl. You guys, if you want to unmute yourself and so she can hear the clapping.
Thank you.